Chapter 11. Neinimium Mendicants. And suddenly, they are four. Sherlock Holmes, John Watson, Lestrade and Hopkins walk out of one door onto Baker Street and walk the short distance to another, from 221 to 221B. The house that is owned by the Religious Brotherhood is solid and well-maintained. A memory of what the street must have looked like back in the true Victorian times. The sound of chanting comes from somewhere up on the first or second floor, but it stops when Lestrade rings the doorbell. And it is Lestrade who is in charge now. He is, after all, the chief inspector. It's his authority which will get them in should the cult leaders appear unwelcoming. But this proves not to be the case. The door opens suddenly, and the man who stands in front of them is smiling benevolently. It is difficult to be sure of his age. He has long grey hair and a craggy face, but there is a youthfulness in his eyes and in the way he carries himself. He's wearing a grey robe, like the man glimpsed in the garden, but there is no sign of a crucifix or any other religious artifact. His feet are bare. He has long toes. "Good evening," he says. "I'm sorry to trouble you at this late hour," Lestrade begins. "I'm with the police. My name is Lestrade. My assistant, Detective Inspector Hopkins. These other gentlemen are helping us with our inquiries." The formal police language is, John is sure, deliberate. "Do you think we could come in?" "What exactly is this about?" "I'm afraid it's about murder, sir. The death of the man who lived at 223 Baker Street."
"You mean Silas Wellborn?"
"We were all saddened by his passing, but that was some 2 months ago, Mr. Lestrade. And we told the police everything we knew at the time." "New information may have come to light, sir." Lestrade is good as the officialese. "We won't keep you long." The man seems reluctant to let them in, but finally relents. "Of course, you must ask your questions," he says. "But we have our evening meditation at 10 o'clock before bed, so I hope you won't mind leaving before then." "I'm sure we won't need to detain you later than that." "Then come in." The inside of the house is nothing like Missy's, or Wellburn's, for that matter. It is simple to the point of austerity, with white walls, wooden floors, and simple light fittings. The windows on each side of the front door are stained glass, not with images, but with different coloured panes that make it impossible to see out, or in. The ground floor consists almost entirely of one single room, not quite a chapel, more a meeting room. There are wooden chairs arranged in a circle, and resting against a grey curtain at the far end, a table that could be used as an altar. A framed sampler carries a quotation, "If less is more, then the least is the most." Gabriel. Though small, with no wasted space, the house gives the strange impression that it is larger inside than out, and more modern too. It is very clean, and also silent. The chanting has not begun again. The man who greeted them gestures for them to sit down, and they find themselves almost in a semicircle, facing him.
"How can I help you?" he asks.
"You might begin by telling us your name," Hopkins says.
"Of course. Forgive me. My name is Dominic."
"And your surname?"
"I don't have one."
Hopkins frowns.
"It might help if I explain the nature of our beliefs and our way of life."
"That would certainly be a good idea," Lestrade agrees.
"Very well. Neinimium means not much. It is our philosophy in two words. We renounce material possessions and adopt a life of poverty and charity. To be a mendicant is to be a beggar. Mendicant orders have always been urban beasts, preaching and ministering to the city's poor, rather than hiding away in grand monasteries. We believe that nearly all the ills of the world have resulted from the rabid consumption of our resources. Food, fuel, forests, water. True enlightenment will only come from self-denial, from fasting, from a refusal to accept material pleasures."
"There are quite a few Christians who believe the same," John remarks.
"I'm sure. We are, however, different in that we do not believe in God or in any form of deity. In fact, we find the idea of a supernatural being quite ridiculous." So what about the chanting which I've been hearing day in, day out? John insists. I hope it hasn't disturbed you.
Not at all. I find it quite soothing.
That's the idea. Dominic is pleased. There is nothing religious about the chanting. In fact, we do not even understand many of the words, which are in Sanskrit. We use it as a form of meditation. It also binds us together as a group. We live our life by having as little as we can. We dispense with anything that is supernumerary to our needs. That includes surnames, by the way. We wear a single robe, we do not need shoes or socks unless we walk out in the street, and then we wear plastic sandals. We have iPads, which we use for reading the works of Gabriel, our founder, but otherwise we have no possessions. We have one meal a day, we try to use sentences with as few words as possible. I am aware that I am breaking that rule now.
And how does all this help you? Lestrade asks, trying to sound polite.
It makes us happy. Having nothing means having nothing to worry about. For example, we never argue in this house because we never converse. That's not a vow of silence, by the way. It's more a domestic arrangement.
He holds up an arm, showing a bare wrist. We never worry about being late because we have no watches or clocks and take no notice of time.
We are all vegans, and the food we eat is so disgusting we never want more of it. So we are healthy. It is true to say that we believe in nothing, and in one sense, we are ahead of the curve because no matter who you are or what you desire, nothing is what you will eventually become.
How long have you been here? Lestrade asks.
Not so very long. We were close to the river, further to the east of the city to begin with, but when this house became available, we moved. That would have been 3 years ago.
So how did you acquire it? Holmes asks, speaking for the first time. I take it you had no money?
As a matter of fact, we have enough money for our needs, but only because we have so few needs.
Dominic gestures at the sampler.
It was bequeathed to us, along with a generous annuity by Gabriel, whom I mentioned to you just a moment ago. He continues. It is his writings that we study to this day. He had acquired his wealth as an investment banker, but then he saw the error of his ways and renounced his fortune and his career. He was a man of enormous wisdom and was loved by everyone until his death.
And when was that?
Many years ago. He passed away quietly of malnutrition. He wouldn't have wanted to go any other way.
Hopkins mutters something under his breath, and John knows what he is thinking. The Ne Nimium mendicants are barking mad. He can see the soft gleam of fanaticism in Dominic's eyes. He's probably skeleton thin under that robe himself.
But you wanted to ask me about the late Silas Welburn, Dominic reminds them.
Yes, sir. Lestrade glances at Holmes, who picks up the interrogation.
Have you or any of your fellow mendicants been assaulted or threatened at any time recently? He asks.
Dominic frowns.
Why do you ask?
We now believe that Mr. Welburn may have been murdered quite deliberately, and that his death might have had nothing to do with the burglary, he explains. At the same time, Missy Hudson, your other neighbour, has been attacked twice. Do you know a lawyer by the name of Cornelius Sutra?
As a matter of fact, that name is familiar to me.
Did he make an offer to buy this house?
But before Dominic can answer, a second member of the sect enters the room through a side door. He is barely in his 20s, with tangled black hair, pale skin, and dark rings around his eyes. There is a smattering of purple acne across his jaw, and there are yellow stains on his fingers. He is also barefoot, dressed in a robe.
Oh, I'm sorry, he says, speaking with a slight French accent.
I didn't know we had visitors.
This is Chief Inspector Lestrade from Scotland Yard. He and his friends were just asking me about Cornelius Sutra.
He turns to the visitors.
Guillaume is one of our youngest mendicants.
Would you like me to leave?
Guillaume asks.
No, stay.
Dominic continues where he left off.
We received a letter from Mr. Sutra. Normally we do not encourage correspondence from friends, and by and large we try to do without friends too. but this was a business communication. It offered us a sizable amount for this property, considerably more than we had paid.
Do you still have the letter? Hopkins asks.
No, I burned it.
Why?
Why would I wish to keep it? I had no need of it. I have burned every letter I've ever received, many of them unopened. But you mentioned the attack on our neighbor.
He turns to Guillaume.
Guillaume was himself threatened and attacked 2 weeks later.
It happened in the street, Guillaume says. I was on my way to Hyde Park, intending to spread the word about our philosophy.
We are always open to new recruits, Dominic adds.
I found my way blocked by a man. He told me that we had made a bad decision and he assaulted me, violently. He punched me in the stomach and in the ribs. I fell to the ground. Then he kicked me again and again and again.
Try not to repeat unnecessary words, Guillaume. Dominic chastises him.
Forgive me, but there were many kicks.
Can you describe the man? John asks. He has suffered the same experience himself. He wonders if it was the same man.
Guillaume shakes his head. He wore a balaclava. I didn't get to see his face, but he was built like an ape. He was tremendously strong.
Quite possibly the same man, then. Did you go to the hospital? Lestrade asks.
Guillaume did not need medical attention, Dominic replies.
Yes, I did, Guillaume complains. He broke one of my ribs.
But you recovered without medical treatment, so medical treatment was not necessary.
Painkillers might have helped.
Thank you, Guillaume. You may leave. Guillaume realizes he has talked out of turn. He bows and goes out the way he came.
As I say, Guillaume has only joined us recently,
Dominic continues after the younger man has left.
He was not too badly hurt.
You didn't report what had happened to the police?
Hopkins asks.
There were no further attacks, and we have heard nothing more from Mr. Sutro. We did not need the police either. Again, Lestrade glances at Holmes, who nods very briefly. There is nothing more to be done here. Lestrade gets to his feet.
You've been very helpful.
Dominic, he says.
I hope so, Chief Inspector.
But if there are any further threats or attacks on your mendicants, you will let me know.
If you wish.
They leave the house. Outside, back in Baker Street, Lestrade takes his leave. Holmes has given him the files that he stole from Sutro's office, and that is where he intends to concentrate his investigation. My view is that we need to follow the money. Find the money, and we will find the red circle, or whoever is behind all this. He adds, if it wasn't a burglary, we still don't know why Welburn was killed.
Because he refused to sell his house? John suggests.
We also don't know why he was paid the same amount of money as Finn Hudson, Holmes adds. Lestrade thinks for a moment. Maybe you should talk to Victor Lynch, he suggests.
And who is Victor Lynch?
He was renting a room from Welburn at the time of the murder. The two of them were very close. If there was any sort of conspiracy behind what happened, Lynch would have got wind of it. Trouble was, he wouldn't say a word to us. Petty criminal and no fan of the police.
Victor Lynch?
John steps forward into the glow of a street lamp. About 50 years old. Scar on his cheek, emphysema. He might have mentioned he was in the army.
That's right.
Lestrade is astonished. It looks as if Watson is performing the same trick as Sherlock Holmes, conjuring up information he can't possibly know.
I was acquainted with a man by that name in Afghanistan,
Watson explains. In fact, I treated him. He'd stood on a landmine.
It blew up?
No, he was lucky. It was defective. But he was so terrified that he suffered from acute stress disorder for weeks afterwards. He was sent home in the end.
Well, maybe he'll talk to you then.
You'll find him at the Dorchester Hotel. He and Welburn had some sort of disagreement, so he ended up there. Lestrade looks at his watch. He's going to be home late again. What will Effie say? I suggest we keep in touch, he adds. We can share information unofficially, of course. but I think we can help each other.
I agree,
Holmes exclaims. He shakes Lestrade's hand.
It's been a pleasure meeting you, Chief Inspector, and you, Mr. Hopkins.
The two pairs go their separate ways. Lestrade and Hopkins disappear immediately into the shadows. Holmes and Watson have only a few steps to Missy's home, but even so, John is aware of a greater darkness rapidly closing in. The Red Circle. He is given a name to the enemy, but where will it strike? Next.